overriding question I want to have for today is there a rational basis for accepting Judaism or Jewish wisdom as authentic, as opposed to, well, I was born into it, which is fine. That's more of an emotional reason. This is what I was raised with. And I'm not knocking that. And that's great for a lot of people, but for many people, especially younger, as generations go on, that's often not enough, not sufficient. And they are confronted with a world, and now that the information is so available via the internet, but also on college campuses, with so many ideas and so many very thoughtful ideas. What is the rational basis for being Jewish when I have many other options available to me, more than ever before? So that's what I'd like you to walk out of here today with maybe a new idea about the rationalization for Judaism. It's not going to be a comparative religion discussion per se, but we are going to talk a little bit about other religions by necessity, just as a matter of contrast. Now, every group, whatever it is, whatever religious or philosophical group, always offers benefits, right? They're always offering you something. That something may be going to heaven. It may be prosperity. It may be bliss. It may be nirvana. So there's always a benefit that's offered, right? And if you ask any of those groups, do other groups offer the same benefit that you offer? The answer is always no, right? The particular benefit we're offering is only available to members of our group or people who practice this practice. In other words, what they're claiming to have is some kind of secret wisdom. They might share the secret with you, but it's some kind of special wisdom that they're claiming. Now, that's a very interesting thought now, because it's easy to be intellectually lazy and say, well, they're all basically saying the same thing. But if you actually talk to them, it's hard to define who them is. I'm not going to certainly paint any group as monolithic. Most of these groups are splintered in many, many permutations. But any one of those, you talk to the leaders or the thoughtful people in those groups, the scholars of that particular group, they will tell you, yeah, we have some special wisdom that if you follow this path, you will get the special benefits, and other paths don't get you there. And that's typically what they say. Now, so where do they get the special wisdom? Where do all these groups, without exception, get the special wisdom? They will all tell you, and there's probably hundreds of these, some kind of what we call a revelation narrative, where the wisdom at one point was revealed, and typically it's to one person who got the revelation and shared it with others and passed on and spread the word and taught it to others. Now, it would be very interesting to spend a few days or a few hours even going through dozens of revelation narratives and seeing patterns, and there are patterns. We don't have time for that, so I'm just going to show you some of the patterns that have been discovered by people doing comparative religion. First of all, we can talk about Christianity. Give me a couple examples. How does Christianity start? Anybody know?
Birth of Jesus.
That's not how Christianity started. Christianity started when a guy named Shaul, Jewish guy, religious Jew, was on his way to Damascus, and he had a vision. And Jesus came to him in his vision. This is 30 years after Jesus died. 30 years after Jesus died, Jesus came to him in a vision and said, you're going to change your name to Paul and go preach my religion. He woke up from his vision and started teaching Christianity. That's how Christianity started. How did Islam start? One guy, Muhammad, one day he falls on the ground on what appears to be an epileptic seizure. He gets up from what happened. He wipes the foam off his mouth and he says, I was not an epileptic seizure. It was actually God speaking to me, and here's what he said. And he was illiterate, so he started dictating to a scribe what God wanted. And he had periodic episodes of this where he fell on the ground and had these trance-like events, and then he woke up from that and revealed to people what he heard as to being God's word, and he told to others. Buddhism. How'd that start? You know. A wealthy Indian prince, Siddhartha Gautama, he's sitting under the Bodhi tree, and he sits in meditation for many days, and he has the experience of his soul climbing higher and higher and higher, level after level, gets the eighth level of the soul, and there's different names for this, and he comes, out of the goodness of his heart, he comes back down to teach the rest of us about it. there are claims that other people have reached the eighth level, maybe dozens of people, but they're all, those all claims are all from Buddha himself. You know, there's nobody else that we know who's alive today who reached that level. So it's all based, again, from one person's testimony. Here's what I experienced, and here's how you can get this. Okay? Mormonism. How did Mormonism start?
Oh, yeah, the guy with the tablet.
Joseph Smith. He's migrating across the United States in Utah. He discovers some tablets written in modern Egyptian. Now, modern Egyptian is very, who knows how to read modern Egyptian? Well, by luck, right next to the tablets, these golden tablets, there's a dictionary translating modern Egyptian into English. He then translates it into English. This is what's called the Book of Mormon. And then he destroys the original tablets in the dictionary because, after all, who needs them? You know, now that he has the Book of Mormon, so he has this book, which he now shares with others. You see, the pattern from all these is what? One individual having a revelation experience, sharing it with others. Yeah? And the experience makes certain claims and offers certain benefits. If you follow this path, this is where it will lead to. This seems to be the pattern throughout history. And the problem with this, if you analyze any of these from a scientific perspective, they have what we call zero credibility, meaning I have no more reason to believe it than not to believe it. It could be true, it could not be true. When you have one person's testimony and no other evidence other than that person's testimony, from a scientist looking at it, says, well, could be, but maybe not. So I have no way to judge. It would be like flipping a coin if I decide that it's right or wrong. I have no other way of knowing. You hear this? Mm-hmm. And if you want to use sociological evidence, they're also going to come out about the same. You're going to find people in each group who are happy, people who are unhappy. And so it's very, very fuzzy ground. We try to bring up any other evidence. Yeah.
It's kind of like, some people have seen a UFO, some people have seen a ghost, and some people haven't. But how do you know? Did they see the ghost? Did they see the UFO?
Yeah. You can choose to believe them if you want to, which is fine if it's comfortable to you, but it's not a rational. I presented this discussion as we're looking for a rational basis and not simply because it feels right. Okay. So now what's really interesting is to take this sort of this analysis to Judaism. And if you look at Judaism, you might think, it follows the same pattern. And those of you who study with me on Friday mornings, we've seen this, haven't we? Open up the Torah. What is the first thing you see? There's a guy named Adam. God speaks to him. Yeah? Revelation narrative? No, same thing. Abraham. God speaks to Abraham. It's followed the same pattern, right? Isaac, right? Follows the same pattern. God speaks to Jacob, right? Everyone, it looks like a classic revelation narrative. The whole book of Genesis looks like any other religion that we've just described, and there may be hundreds of others. Until you get to the book of Exodus. When you get to the book of Exodus, where we happen to be on Friday mornings presently, the chapter known as Jethro, Yithro, Yisro, something very different says there. It doesn't say God spoke to Moses, and Moses went down and told the rest of the people the story. What does it say? It says that there were 600,000 men and their wives, that's 600,000 women, and their children, so we're talking about 2 or 3 million people, all stood at the base of this mountain, Mount Sinai, and they heard God say, I am the Lord, don't have any other gods, Moses, come up the mountain, get the rest of the Torah. They heard those words. Now, if you were a scientist analyzing this, you would say, what would you say when you read that? When you're putting in the parameter or the spectrum of all these revelations, you'd say, what chutzpah those Jews have, you know? They're going to claim that 3 million people heard this story. That way, the question you would ask to the scientist is, if you're being critical, a critical mind person is, it's clearly a fantasy, it's clearly a myth, but how did that myth get started? How did that myth, that 3 million people stood there and heard God speak, as opposed to every other religion we've seen, how did that myth get started? How can we come up with a plausible historical narrative that would explain the other religions? It's very easy, right? When you have one founder, it's very easy to come up with a narrative that explains Islam or Christianity or the other religions, right? Even if we don't have all the historical facts, we can come up with a plausible way. Why did people decide to believe this? But how do you get people, how do you come up with a narrative that explains the story in the Torah, how it got so widespread? there's arguably three possible ways of analyzing it. What we call the past narrative, the present narrative, and the future narrative. And it works like this, very simple. The past narrative, remember, we're taking the critical idea, the critical stance that it's made up. This is a fiction. So the question is, how did it get made up? So the past narrative means like this. I'm the guy who wrote the, who made it up, okay? And I want to convince you, we'll start with the present one, it's a little easier to understand. The present one is like this. I come to you and I say, I have this book. Here's this book I just wrote. My name is Joe, and I just wrote this book. And the book says, God spoke to you and me and told us that I'm the Lord and don't have any other gods, and Moses built this mountain. We're going back a few thousand years, okay? If I came to you with this book and said that and showed it to you, what would you say?
I didn't say that.
I don't remember hearing that, right? So the present theory doesn't work so well with the Jewish narrative that could have been how the lie got started. What about the past narrative? How does the past narrative work? The past narrative is, I have this book, and it says, God spoke to the Jewish people and said, I'm the Lord, don't have any gods, and let's go to the mountain. Now, it happened a couple years ago. It happened, say, 100 years ago. Now, if it never happened, what's the problem with this narrative? If it never happened, remember, we're assuming it never happened. God spoke to your grandparents.
My grandparents never told me.
You never heard the story before, right? How could you make up a story? How could I make up a story and convince you that it happened in the past? If it happened to your ancestors, you never heard about it. Well, it happened, 3,000 years ago, and there was some event in between that caused massive amnesia. Maybe it was some kind of disaster, and it was forgotten about. And now I'm coming back and showing you what happened that your ancestors forgot about. And that's kind of what you have to say, right? Unless you can come up with another scenario where I could convince you that this book says this happened to your ancestors and you never heard about it before. Because that's what past theory says. The past theory says, I'm coming to you with something that allegedly happened in the past. The only other possibility would be future theory. Future theory is where I come to you and say, this is going to happen sometime in the future. The Jewish people have stand on Mount Sinai. And God's going to say, I'm the Lord, don't have the God, and Moses comes to the mountain. And it hasn't happened yet, but here it is. Here's the book that's going to be given. That doesn't really work either in this case, because it's, right? Because it hasn't happened yet, and the book says it already happened. So we can really eliminate present, the future. I'll just use the whiteboard a little bit. We can eliminate the future theory right away. Future theory is the easiest one to eliminate. So I'm going to put past, present, and future. They all have holes, by the way. They all have problems. But I would like to show you each of the problems. The future one's the simplest one to eliminate. So I'm going to just strike that off. The present theory is a little more tempting that it happened right now. Present theory maybe could happen. Is it possible? You say it's impossible. So I wonder if it's possible for me to convince you that it happened to you. It's happened to you. You're all aware of cults. And do you remember some years back the cult that got a lot of press called the Heaven's Gate cult? Mm-hmm. Remember how that happened? What do you remember
the
about
kids.
Heaven's Gate? They weren't just
the
kids. They weren't kids.
I just remember they were wrapped in. They had sneakers, they all wrapped in white, and then they all
committed
suicide all at the same time.
So this guy Marshall Applewhite. Right? Marshall Applewhite, what's interesting about the Marshall, Marshall Applewhite was the guy who was born in Texas, he had a PhD, educated guy, he had one of his series of various periods of depression in his life, and he founded a couple of different cults. I think the Evans Gate cult was his third or fourth cult he founded. And in California, that's average. I don't know how many the average cult leader found, but he had four visions that got him to where we got him in the news. The first vision was that there's going to be a gate open to heaven that we can all go through, okay? And that was his first vision, that heaven's gate's going to open and we can all go through it. The second vision he had was that it's going to be easier to get through heaven's gate if you're wearing black Nikes. So then his followers went out and they all got black Nikes. His third video.
He's kind of a persuasive speaker.
in some regards.
Well, that's what we...
You're kind of a public speaker.
That's what we want to find...
Motivational speaker.
That's what we want to try to analyze. And it, we want to try to analyze what is it about, right? The third vision he had was that women are going to have an easier time getting through heaven's gates than men. So he, after this vision happened, he got all the men together in the cult. This is down near San Diego, and he got the, got some topical anesthetic and X-Acto knife and gave each one their hand. He said, "Okay, gentlemen, this is just to take a second." And they dropped their pants. And you know, one, two, three. It's a lot easier now to get into heaven's gate. His fourth and final vision was, this is right when the Halley-Bopp comet was going
by.
The Halley-Bopp comet was passing, and it had some on its tail of the comet. There was something that astronomers didn't know what it was. Something, a little blip on the tail of the comet. And his vision was that tail, that blip, was actually the spaceship coming back to get us. And if we time it right, we will all be transported to the spaceship. And the way to do that is we're all going to take this phenobarbital, I think, that and then wrap a plastic bag over our heads. And if we don't all do it at the right time, we will all be transported magically up to the spaceship. And there were 39 or 40 people who committed suicide together that day, and Marshall Applewhite made it last. A video at the very end of himself, or a movie, where he said something like, "What a joke," you know, right before he killed himself. And that's, and they discovered this. It was interesting.
Did he kill himself too?
Yeah, he killed himself too. They found him there with all the other people looking for
the
video.
But hadn't the men already bled to death at that time? He...
No, no, that was a different day. They bandaged themselves.
So he basically was saying this was a joke and it was unbelievable how many people I convinced.
Yeah, what's interesting is...
How are you relating this back?
What's interesting is that this all took place 20 minutes from the University of San Diego, where there is one of the major centers for study of cults. And so when the police are doing their investigation, the professors were also, you know, following along, learning about this cult and learning about Marshall Applewhite. And they wanted to know about the victims. What kind of people were these that were brought into this cult and followed him to do these crazy things? Right, and found out that none of them, that every member of this cult, every one of those 39 people, had a college degree. Mm-hmm. Numerous members had advanced degrees, PhDs, MAs, PhDs, MDs, JDs. These are all educated people, all intelligent people. Not one of them, not a single one of them, had any history of any psychological problems. Not one had ever been to a therapist that they could find a trace of. Now, what does that mean? They're all so crazy they didn't even know they needed help? Maybe.
You don't get advanced degrees.
But out of this study came something that you can Google. It's called the Applewhite Theorem. The Applewhite Theorem is that basically goes like this. Anybody of any level of intelligence could potentially be led to believe just about anything as long as the facts cannot be verified. Meaning, you see, about the mothership, there's no way to verify it. Now, if Marshall Applewhite had said, the spaceship that brought your parents here is now returning, just pick up the phone. Mom, did you come here on a spaceship, right? You could verify that, and maybe some people would not have killed themselves, right? The key to the Applewhite Theorem is that it's a non-verifiable claim. As soon as it's verifiable, then some intelligent people won't be suckered into it. But this is the theorem.
What about the idea about the frog going into the water, and he's like, the water's getting hotter and hotter, and then at the end, the water's so hot, it doesn't jump out. Like, here are these people, they bought the tennis shoes, what was the next step? They're already in. They're in a little bit deep, and now they can't see, like, the last layer.
Yeah, okay. There's certainly, it's not, it didn't all happen in one day. Absolutely correct.
What was the third layer after the tennis shoes?
The self...
Mutilation.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. So see, they're already committed.
Okay. Right. The point is, though, that it's unverifiable. And if you take this theorem, you can apply it to any religion, okay? It fits any religion. It fits Christianity. Paul comes and says, I had this vision, and Jesus came to me, and if you follow this, you'll go to heaven, right? It's unverifiable, right? So there will be people who will be convinced by this, very intelligent people. Islam says the same thing. All the religions say this. Every claim of every religion that has survived beyond cult status, it follows this pattern, where the claim is made claims that are unverifiable, and therefore you can choose to believe it, and if you're an intelligent person, you might be led to it. It might be overstages, right? Let's apply this to Judaism now. So it's easy to talk about other groups, but let's turn the lens on our own tradition. How does Applewhite theorem inform us or educate us about our own tradition? So remember, we're taking the very critical stance that Judaism is made up, completely fictional, like any other, you know, religion that we might not believe in. We have no rational reason to believe in Judaism, but we want to find out exactly how did it get made up. So what's the scenario? So I come to you, we've already rejected future, right now we're in present theory, okay? I come to you and say, well, do you remember when God spoke to us? Well, I don't remember. Say I could somehow convince you God spoke to you, give you enough drugs, and convince you that God spoke to you, okay? So what does the book actually say to do, right? What are the claims of the book that it says to do? First of all, it says, men, you go here to chapter 17 of Genesis, men, you need to take a knife and drop your pants, and right? Not quite the same as Marshall Applewhite, but there is a surgical requirement in Judaism, which is pretty remarkable, pretty strong. If you don't believe in it, to do that to yourself or to your baby, if you're a mother, you have to be pretty convinced that this is true to do this, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
What else does the book say? Well, it says over here, you're getting this God that spoke to you, which you may not remember clearly because maybe you were sort of drugged out at the time. But I'm trying to convince you of this religion. This God that spoke to you is going to take you to the promised land, and you're going to get a beautiful apartment. Maybe in Haifa, right? Maybe Tel Aviv, okay? Oh, by the way, says the book, 3 times a year, ladies, you should know that all able-bodied men, all soldiers, all the menfolk are going to go have a celebration away from home in Jerusalem. And you know all the barbarous peoples who surround you, your enemies who want to attack you? Don't worry. The God who spoke to you promises you that he won't let them attack you 3 times a year. Passover, Shavuos, and Sukkot, he's not going to let them attack you those 3 times. What happened to Applewhite's theorem? Applewhite's theorem is that it's non-verifiable. Here we have a promise that's going to happen not, you know, on a spaceship, not some future time, hundreds of years in the future, but this year, once you move into the promised land, this God who spoke to you, and you maybe remember, maybe don't remember, is going to protect your borders. All right. Next, let's turn to another interesting part of the Torah, which I think is one of the most remarkable. It says, most of you are farmers. 95% of you Israelites are farmers. Every 7 years, this God who spoke to you wants you to let your land lie fallow. Don't plant your land. Okay, fine. What's the big deal? Oh, you thought it meant like one farmer 1 year, another farmer. No, all the Jewish farmers everywhere, the same year, don't plant anything. Oh, you're worried about what you can eat? If you don't plant for a whole year, it's no problem. The God who spoke to you is going to give you a triple crop the year before. So you'll have not only enough for this year 6, but if year 7, even carrying you into year 8. Is that a non-verifiable claim? Promise? It's totally verifiable. All you have to do is live it for one period of 7 years. You'll see whether it's true or not. You hear the problem? As soon as we start trying to analyze Judaism and the Torah from the perspective of Applewhite's theorem or just the analysis of other religions, we have some problems. The Torah makes claims that it shouldn't make. If it was a person, Joe, or whoever it is, who made up the Torah, is trying to sell it to people as, believe me, God spoke to me here, spoke to all of us, it's a problem. If it was God just spoke to me, that'd be one thing. But when God spoke to us, and I'm making these promises, we've got a problem. Yeah.
But what if it was it all written after these things already happened? Sorry, that's my phone.
I got somebody's phone up there.
Please stop.
It's a very complicated, I'm saying, like, if it was, written, after this happened, and then they're writing about that this happened. Therefore, there's proof.
They verified it.
They're verifying it.
They would be verifying it, but then they presented it as it happened. You're agreeing with me that present theory doesn't make sense for Judaism. You're asking me about past theory.
Well, I'm saying, what it sounds like to me is you're saying the Torah, you can see that they were promised this and it happened. Therefore, God was correct, the prophesizing, whatever. The message was proven.
No, I didn't say it happened. I'm saying the scenario, try to imagine the scenario where this Torah got published for the first time. When it was published at some time, somebody wrote the text out in the back room, said, presumably the ink was dry before he or she presents it to people, says, here I am, I'm Joe, and I wrote this. I didn't write this. The book says Moses wrote it, but I'm trying to pass it off to you. Now, you've never seen this before. We're trying to imagine the scenario that this actually, this fiction, this myth got created. So, by the way, scholars, the secular university scholars reject present theory. They don't accept it. This idea that you were drugged or something and you were convinced it happened to you. They all hold, like, anyone who holds by theory at all, they hold by past theory. Because the idea that there was some massive drug trip, it just doesn't fly with the scholar. FYI, there are some lay people who have that theory, and they're kind of funny theories, but the scholarship has rejected that as well. It just seems so too implausible that the entire people were somehow drugged out and had this hallucination. So most scholars fall in the past theory world. The past theory means, I'm coming to you, I'm Joe, and I say, I've got this Torah that was written by Moses, and Moses spoke to your ancestors, and, oh, you didn't hear about it, okay, that's okay. There was some kind of event that caused your ancestors to forget about it. But again, according to Applewhite's theory, it's only going to really take off if it's making claims that can't be verified. Because as soon as you could verify it, you're never going to practice it if the claims don't come true. I'm giving it to you now, saying, will you follow this religion? You'll say, sure, you'll follow it for how long? You'll follow it for 6 years. As soon as the 6 year comes and you don't get that triple crop, as soon as all your men go away and you're left vulnerable and you are attacked, you can say, it's not true.
Yeah, but the Jews have loopholes. They figured out how to do the crops without, how to do it within the law, without doing it that way.
I'm not aware of such loopholes.
Yeah, there's for the Jubilee and the Jubilee year, there's like ways that you can get around. I forget what they exactly are, but I know they have them in Israel.
I'm not aware of such loopholes. Today, I'll just say, today those laws, those laws about the not planting.
They get someone else to borrow the property for the time.
Let me just explain it. That those laws are not considered in force today. Meaning the rabbis, those laws are considered in force only when there's a temple.
When there's what?
When there's a temple in Jerusalem.
So people still do weird things, like they get people to buy.
What I'm trying to say is that you're asking a good question. That after the temple was destroyed, the rabbi said, let's keep those laws anyway out of good practice, but we're not really doing it. We don't need to do it. So when they made that enactment, they said, if times are tough, you can sell your land to a non-Jew, but it's because it's not really doing it anyway. It's not required now anyway.
That's a good point. Okay.
Yeah, so that's important. So
I can't put anything past you.
You thought about that.
Go ahead.
It's a good question. But we have these remarkable statements that don't hold up to Applewhite's theorem. So how do we deal with it? Now, I have a rabbi. And this is I wanted to print this hand up, but both pictures that I tried to access today were unavailable to me. So I'm going to put it on the screen, and I'll show it to you. I have a rabbi, and his name is Rabbi Yitzchak Berkowitz. And I asked him this question. I said to him, Rabbi Berkowitz, how do you know that all this stuff is authentic, this Judaism stuff? Where did you learn from? He said, I learned from my Rebbe. My rabbi. Well, who's his rabbi? His rabbi is Rabbi Nachum Parsovitz. Well, who's he? Well, he's the student Rabbi Baruch Ben Leibowitz. Well, who's he? He's the Rabbi Chaim Soloveitchik of Brisk. And through my rabbi, Rabbi Berkowitz, I was able to trace back this list, and I'll show it to you. This is me at the bottom. Oh, that's Rabbi Berkowitz at the bottom, and my name's just after that. And his name is 137. And if you go backwards on this list, you go all the way back up, and there's unbroken rabbi to student, all the way back up to the top of the list, which is Moses.
Oh, wow.
Okay? So that's a remarkable thing. So what I have, so I don't have this problem of, you know, if you go to any of you, if I asked you this question, how would you answer? Was there a religious Jew in your ancestry? Anyone who's not a convert. I'm talking about anyone who was born Jewish. You go to any person born Jewish. Did you have religious observant Jews in your past? What would they say?
Yeah.
Everyone did.
Of course,
yeah. Every single one did. You know, before 200 years ago, there was no, every Jew was religious. That was what it was. You were Jewish, you were religious. You kept Shabbat, you kept kosher, and so on, right? So then we have an unbroken chain. So this problem with the past theory was, well, I don't remember, I never heard this from my parents. That was the big problem, right?
Mm-hmm.
But we solved that problem for Judaism. Because even if you didn't hear from your parents, you know that go back a couple of generations and there was this chain, unbroken chain, all the way back. Now, still, it's not a perfect theorem, right? You could say, well, maybe this happened, maybe it was invented and somewhere along this line this fiction is created. Yeah? How could that happen? Can you come up with a scenario how that could have happened? How this chain from Moses to today could have been created?
Well, let's say your rabbi, Rabbi Berkowitz, lied to you.
Okay.
Rabbis have a lot of...
Right. So
he could have made something up.
He may have lied to me. So what I have to do is I have to verify, and I have to go and find historical data, and I can do this, and that people have done this. His chain, by the way, is not the only... He's not the only one who has this memory. We can find various rabbis who have, and they're not this exact same one, but they all eventually converge at some point in the past. We have parallel chains, and they're all over the world. And every Torah scroll around the world that mentions the sabbatical year mentions they're all consistent. So we have this remarkably consistent claim of both the written and this chain, and no matter where you go around the world, Ashkenazi, Sephardi, Yemen, every group of Jews has a similar but parallel chain going all the way back. So now what do you say? Well, could it have been created?
Does Muslims have a chain going back to Muhammad?
Absolutely, I'm sure they do. But remember, what is Muhammad's claim?
He alone.
God spoke to me, and here's what he told me to tell you. Right? That's what. And I don't believe Muslims lie to their children. So if they tell their children we have this unbroken chain to Muhammad, I believe them. Why do they believe in Muhammad? What was their reason for believing Muhammad? That's the question you should ask. Do they have a rational basis for believing in Muhammad?
Maybe they had a need to believe.
Maybe. Why did your ancestors, why did our ancestors believe in Moses? What's the claim?
Because we didn't need to believe.
That's not what the claim is. The story says because God spoke to all of us, 3 million people, said, I am the Lord, don't follow the gods, Moses come up the mountain and get the rest of the Torah.
I thought it was too much for the people. They had to.
They heard the first two. God said, I am the Lord. Don't have other gods. Moses, come up the mountain. They heard those three statements.
Really? It was just Moses and God up on the mountain. The people weren't there.
Correct.
So it's the same as Muhammad.
They heard God say, I am the Lord. Don't have other gods. Moses, come up the mountain. That's what the story says. You can open the Torah. It says in the Torah. This is not an oral tradition. It says in the written Torah, every Torah you find, whether it's in South America or China, wherever it is, they all say the same story. It says that all three... So how do you convince all these Jews around the world that God spoke to their ancestors, all 3 million of them? Could that have been invented? Could that have been invented story? We're assuming that it's invented, but how could it be invented?
Well, one more issue on this. After that happened, everybody was wiped out. The whole generation before they came into Israel was wiped out. They all had the Mount Sinai experience. Then they all sinned against God. And then before they could get into the new land, a whole bunch of them had to be wiped out to start anew. So there are, except maybe one guy who went forward.
Well, that's not what the story says.
The story says... That generation that heard was wiped out. It says
the men over age 20 died, except for two. All the women survived, and all the men under age 20.
Okay, well, in my theory, I just brought it up because it came up, but it doesn't quite cut the mustard or whatever, because the kids, obviously they had kids. Just because they didn't go into Israel doesn't mean their kids didn't go in. The kids were talking to their parents, though.
The kids were at Mount Sinai, according to the story. That's part of the problem. The kids were all there. Anyone under age 20 was survived and went into the land. So, again, you have the same problem. You have this, how do you invent, if you're one invented religion and convince people that this happened to your ancestors, that's fine when you don't make claims that can't be verified. It's not so fine when the claims can't be verified and you have a tradition that keeps going back. Meaning, it goes back to the original claim of the 3 million. Now, the 3 million, I think, is the key claim. I think the 3 million is the key claim. And I don't think that it can be replicated anymore. Now, maybe it could be. You could say it's possible, right? It's possible that it was a natural event. Give me a natural event that would count for this story that 3 million people saw and heard God at Mount Sinai, and they told it to their children. They passed it on all the way down to us. Give me a plausible, natural, even implausible, but some naturalistic explanation that would explain that, not a supernatural. The supernatural is that really happened. The natural that did not happen, like God did not speak to them, it's all fiction, but give me a naturalistic way that could have happened.
Moses had a friend.
Moses had a friend?
Who impersonated God.
Okay.
I don't know.
The fact that 3 million people experienced something is hard. You accept they experienced something. It's just a question of what they experienced.
Maybe it was an eclipse or something. Maybe it was something that rarely happens, that they thought it was suddenly became dark or something, and some astronomical thing that happened that day. And they believed that it was a supernatural, and then they all believed the same thing, that it was God coming down and speaking or something.
Or
any other idea?
First of all, you said that it's easy to convince. First of all, if you can convince 37 college people with educations to kill themselves over nothing, then you can convince somebody of anything. Mm-hmm. So
correct. That's Alford's theorem.
Okay, right. So given that, it doesn't matter whether it happened or not. You could convince anybody of anything anyway. So whether it happened or not, even if it never happened, you could still convince all those people.
As long as the claims are unverifiable. Mm-hmm. As long as the promises are unverifiable. As soon as they're verifiable, as soon as, right, for example, Apple's theorem only works in the present. If it's in the past, again, if he had said, the spaceship that brought your parents here is coming to get you, some of them would have picked up the phone and called mom and dad to tell me, why don't you tell me about the spaceship? It only worked because it was a present theory, not past. Present theory doesn't work. The only plausible theory is past theory. Applewhite had come and... So the only plausible theory for Applewhite, from Applewhite's case, is present theory. It has to be present and unverifiable.
What about all the people that are Christians that all over the world say that they heard Jesus, or that Jesus has done all these things for them, and they're living every day, and they're attesting to all that stuff? I mean, of course, just because God gave something to Jesus doesn't mean he didn't give something to somebody else. So I mean, I'm not saying, but I'm just saying, everything can be
But they're not claiming they all are hearing God say the exact same thing at the exact same time. That's not what they're claiming. People make all kinds of claims. Any individual can make any claim they want. And that's what we started off by saying, that any individual claim, it has zero believability because there's no more reason to believe it than not to believe it. What makes the Jewish story more believable is that it's 3 million people, the claims that 3 million people had this experience. Now you accept, Lucas is saying that she accepts that it's plausible 3 million people had some kind of experience. The question is, what was that experience? Was it like it's described in the Torah? Is that what you're saying?
Yes. Could have been an earthquake.
So, what's the problem with that approach, the rational problem with it, is that there's a rule of history that you don't have to accept, but a rule of history that seems to me a pretty good rule, that history tends to repeat itself. When, you know, not exactly, but there's patterns of history you can follow, right? This is something that, why did it ever happen, ever again? No other time did a massive group of people have some kind of hallucination or whatever it was, some kind of experience that turned into a religion where they believed God spoke to them. I mean, if it could happen by a natural event, why didn't it? Now, you can say, well, it was just a fluke. But we tend not to believe in flukes. Do you know what I mean? What are the odds of that happening? What are the odds of it happening? Of a massive group of people had experienced an eclipse, or whatever you want to come up with, and then believing it was God speaking, if you're saying that it was a natural event, but it was just like this really fluky thing that happened, what are the odds of that happening? There must be less than 50-50, because it never happened any other time. Is it 1 in 100? 1 in 1,000? 1 in a million? If you say it's 1 in 1,000.
Well, there is such thing as an eclipse, and, you know, it does happen.
But it doesn't cause people to believe that God is speaking to all of us at the same time.
I know, but maybe that's what they thought it meant. Maybe they didn't hear it, but they were like, you know, in the presence of such an eclipse, and like, it's God coming down and telling us something.
The Torah says they all heard God say, I am the Lord, don't believe in God, Moses come up the mountain. That's what they heard. At some point, we're assuming this is a fiction, someone publishes that and says, and people are going to say, that's not what I heard. I heard we had an eclipse. I didn't learn from my parents that God said those words. You have to convince me, you're publishing this, you have to convince me that this is true. If I never heard of it before from my parents, why would I believe it? You're going to say, well, it could happen that the story evolved. Maybe, but it never happened anywhere else in history that such a story came about. The odds against it happening are enormous. So, fine, you can believe that it was a fluky thing that happened. What we're saying is you're more likely to believe in a 1 in 1,000 than in the chance that this happened by a fluke than the 999% chance that what? 999 out of 1,000 chance that what? That it was not a natural event. That it was a supernatural event. I mean, given the evidence, what is the evidence leaning? The evidence leaning towards that it was a natural event that happened, 1 in a million chance that it could happen, but it did happen? Or the vast, strong odds that it was like this described?
So then,
if you're looking at rationally, see, there's part of me that can't accept the idea that anything supernatural ever happens, and therefore that's going to overwhelm all the evidence that says this really happened, even though the odds of it happening naturally are so tiny. If you went to Las Vegas or Reno, and play dice and threw a double six and won the pot, you'd be very lucky. What if you won through two double sixes in a row? What's the odds against that happening? I worked this out this morning. 1 in 1,296. What if you roll 3 double sixes? 1 in 46,656. What about 4 double sixes? By then they're arresting you, right? Right, and you're in front of, right? Four double sixes is 1.6 million. At what do you even say to the judge? The judge has you just threw 4 or 5 double sixes in a row. Okay, what's the judge going to say to you? You're a criminal, right? You blow the dice. You say, no, I got lucky. Are you going to get off this one? Or are you talking about traffic tickets before? Are you going to get off this ticket or not? Mm-hmm. Why not?
Impossible.
So rational people know that improbable things don't happen. We don't believe in improbable things. We don't believe you got lucky and rolled 5 double sixes in a row. But you're going to believe that this completely improbable natural event occurred that caused all these people massive belief that God was speaking to them, saying, I'm the Lord, don't have other gods, and Moses come up the mountain. That would be an irrational belief, to believe that it was a natural... You know, I'm suggesting to you that a rational belief would be that it really happened. As against our upbringing is that these supernatural events don't happen, a rational person would look at Jewish tradition, the Jewish claim, and the chain of tradition, and the predictions it makes as more likely than any other explanation.
So do you think that's why we have more wisdom? At your point, because the Jews have more wisdom because our claims are more believable?
I didn't say that, no.
Okay.
I don't know if that's true. But let's talk about wisdom for a second. Talk about what Torah is. Let's just talk about what Torah is and what this might mean to us, practically speaking. I'm offering you a rational a way to approach Judaism as a unique claim. It really is a unique claim. You don't find this in any other religion, any other philosophical system that I'm aware of, that this claim that we have a national episode of revelation, not an individual, and that we have an unbroken, and that plus the unbroken chain of tradition. And even if you look at Hinduism, which has such claims of national revelation, guess what? All those 3 million people who heard their God speak, K-R-I-S-H-N-A, when they heard him speak, they all died, right? And only one guy survived to tell the rest of the world about it, right? Even their claim is based on one person. No one else has these two features. What is this then? Why would it make sense? And I'm really, I think, addressing your question, Ellen. Mm-hmm. What is this Torah that we're talking about? This is, I think, the most interesting part of today's discussion. I think what was said so far is very interesting. It's very important for you and your children to have a sense of why be Jewish. Why should I be Jewish? Well, we have an unbroken tradition. But what is this Torah exactly? How are we supposed to understand it? I'd like to ask you to play a thought experiment with me. Pretend you're God. Put yourself in God's shoes, okay?
Stop. That won't be my job.
You want to create, you're infinite. You have no needs. Oh, you have no needs. You're everything. You have infinite wisdom, infinite everything, right? There's one thing you're lacking. There's one thing you're not able to do as God. And that is because you're all alone, you're not able to give. In order to give requires a recipient to express the divine quality of giving. So you're going to create a world where there are creatures who are sentient and able to receive, and then you can give to them, right? Now, to be meaningful to give to them, it has to the most meaningful gift you can give them is the ability to choose and to make decisions and so on. So you're going to create a world for them where they really have competing ideas and temptations and so on, so they can make really meaningful choices. Let's pretend it's like what we know as in the computer age as a virtual reality. Like a virtual reality that they're going to be able to operate in. Now, mm-hmm. What's the greatest gift you can give to your creatures that you're creating? Wouldn't it be
free will?
Well, free will should be part of it.
What about this? You get just the fact that you made them alive.
Well, made them alive, but if they end up killing themselves and each other, then what is not so good? Right? You want it, right? Would it be awesome if you gave them, not only did you give them free will, but in addition to free will, you gave them the algorithm that's running the virtual reality so that they could take charge of their own destiny? That would be the ultimate free will, that you can actually control your own destiny, that you're not robots. Give them the program behind the computer. Give them the keys to the car, so to speak. Wouldn't that be the ultimate gift? So that is how our tradition teaches what a primordial version of Torah is. Torah is a set of data, which is the programming behind this reality that we think is so real, but it's actually a created reality, this physical world we live in. There's a programming behind it, if you will. That's what we call Torah. Now, it comes to us in this interesting format, which is like a story, and it's deceptive because the story just looks like a story. In the beginning, God created, and Adam, and Eve, and Noah, and Abraham, Isaac, Sarah, and Sarah, Rebecca, Rachel, Leah, all that. It just looks like a story. But those people who study it in depth start learning that there's the keys to all creation there. How to interpret it in that way is what we call Kabbalah. Kabbalah is a area of interpretation of the Torah that relates the text of the Torah to the creation itself. That's what Kabbalah is. And that's why it's always been like a secret wisdom and a special mystical wisdom, because obviously you're dealing with fire here. You don't want to entrust you don't give the keys to the car to your 5-year-old. Right? Maybe not even to your 16-year-old. You're very careful about something that's so potentially, has a lot of potential for good, but a lot of potential for danger as well. And you're very careful who should have access to that until they're ready. And that's where this comes from. That's how we have always understood what Torah is. So when you're, when, but where is the Torah then? Where is the ultimate Torah? You know, you think it's the scroll, but the scroll isn't the full Torah. The scroll is like, it's part of it, but how you interpret it matters too. So really the Torah is both. It's the scroll plus what's up here. And when, and if you read my Friday emails, last Friday I wrote one called Ask Your Rabbi. The idea of a rabbi is that every one of us should be rabbis. In traditionally, rabbi is not a job description. Rabbi, it means you and I, anyone who's reached a certain level of wisdom, of knowledge. And I would hope that every one of us could reach that level. Why not? Why should it be held back from anybody? That would be my